Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the library and tonight's event with Gerald Chertavian. So first, I thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening, for being here tonight with Gerald's book, For Sale. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis. And finally, this program is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Okay, so now let me turn the podium over to Lisa Chin to introduce our special guest. Thanks very much.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for the warm response. I'm Lisa Chin. I'm the executive director of Year Up Puget Sound. And I have the great pleasure tonight of introducing Gerald Chertavian, who is the founder and chief executive officer of Year Up. What we like to say at Year Up is that we are part of a movement. And as you know, every movement needs a leader. And in this movement to close the opportunity divide, which is the gap that exists between those talented young adults who don't have a chance and all those talented young adults who do have a chance and have access, our purpose is to help bridge and close that opportunity divide. And we are incredibly blessed and fortunate to have a leader in this movement in Gerald Chertavian. He's the perfect example of somebody who lives the Year Up motto of high expectations and high support. Gerald founded our organization 12 years ago, but his history and his belief in the young people of tomorrow started long before that, with his very first little brother, a man named David, who he'll tell you a little bit more about. One of the most inspirational things Gerald continually reminds me of is to lift as you climb. This book, A Year Up, is a testament to how Gerald has devoted his life to that philosophy and how his lifting while he climbs has resulted in 5,000 alumni and many, many more following in their steps, and they will find that there is a hand there for them, Gerald's hand, our hands, and that as they climb, there is a hand for them, and they will also be extending their hands to those who come after him. Gerald is one of the most charismatic men that I know, and it is very much my privilege to call him friend and leader. He always speaks from his heart, and I'm sure that he can tell this story about A Year Up far better than I can. So with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome the founder and chief executive officer of Year Up, Gerald Chertavian.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you very much, Chris, and to the library. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. 25 years ago, through the Big Brothers program, I was matched with a young boy named David, as Lisa referenced, who was from the Dominican Republic. He lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan at the corner of Rutgers and Delancey Street, which at that point in 1988 was one of the most heavily photographed crime scenes in New York City. And if anyone was anywhere near New York City or even any major urban area during the late 80s, the height of the crack AIDS epidemic, which literally ravaged communities, you know, took communities and literally turned them up on their end. And so I met with this young boy, David, and then for the next 3 years spent every Saturday of my life with him, religiously would go to an end Saturday, and got to understand this housing development and what happened and how they operate. And David's four brothers, Willie, Carlos, Edwin, and Julio, and their mother, Cornelia, who is wonderful. And Cornelia doesn't speak a lot of English. She is an amazing mother, hugely loving mother. I imagine she kept those five boys out of all of harm's way in one of the most heavily photographed crime scenes in New York City. And so for 3 years being with David, it was so clear to me how talented he was. I mean, he was a deeply gifted, smart, capable boy at that point. He's now 35. He's an extended member of our family. We call him somewhere between Uncle David and brother, and he's kind of different things, whether he's to my son or to me now. But what you saw is David had everything he needed, but he didn't have access and opportunity. And so he fundamentally lacked what he truly needed to take all the talent he was born with and to realize the potential that he had. And so it struck me at that point that why was David's zip code limiting his potential? Why was the bank balance of his mother limiting his potential? Well, the school system he attended, well, the color of his skin, and combined, those things were creating for David what I call an opportunity divide. An example of what that looks like when you talk about educational inequality or the school system David went to, I'll never forget it. His mom, Cornelia, asked me to go to parents' night. And I was so proud. I think I was 21 or 22 years old, and I got to go and be a parent. And so I walked into PS 56 and found the classroom and walked up to the teacher, and I said, "Hi, I'm Gerald Chatavian. I'm here as David's parent, and I'd love to hear about how he's doing." And the teacher looked up, I can still see his face, looked up at the sky and scratched his head, and he said, "David, David, David, which one is he?" And I thought, if that doesn't describe what educational inequality looks like in this country, nothing does. And I remember having to go make something up for his mother when I got home, because I was so embarrassed that I couldn't even say anything about her son because the teacher didn't know who her son was. And so at that point in my life, I was, when you talk about Europe being in the human transformation business, the first transformation at Europe was certainly my own, which was understanding what poverty looked like in this country, understanding what lack of opportunity looked like up close, and especially with a young boy who I love. And at that point, what I decided is I want to try to do something about this, and ended up writing my essays to get into Harvard Business School back in '89 about starting a program to somehow close this opportunity divide. And those essays, I think they sent me recently from business school, as they were done on a typewriter, which gives you a sense it was 89, not 99 or 2009. But it had sketched out back then that is there a way to connect talented young people with the economy and with opportunity so that they can realize their potential? And knowing that this was not only about social and economic justice, it was about actually what our employers need, what our economy needs, what our country needs, which is connecting supply and demand of talent. So David really, for anytime someone asks about Europe, I always go back to David was and will always be the inspiration for why Europe exists. Just last week, David called me, and he runs his own company now. He's a graduate from the School for Visual Arts in New York City. He's an animation expert. He can do things with animation that you would just be amazed at. He worked for Walt Disney for about 5 years. He's going back for his master's degree now. He does some teaching. He runs his own company. And he just got a huge job, actually for the Pearson Foundation, of all people. Guess who owns Viking Penguin? Pearson. I thought, how prophetic is that, that my little brother has now got his biggest contract ever, where he's hired 6 people to work for him to create a bunch of animated shorts for children's books for the Pearson Foundation, the very publisher of the book that David inspired. I thought, boy, if life isn't circular, right? And everything comes around. So David was always, when I think about that power of one, something that taught me and showed me something which changed my life forever, which was what was happening to David was wrong. It was morally wrong, it was economically wrong, it was socially wrong. And it didn't have to be. It was fixable. We could do something about this. And as David always said, you know, Gerald, I probably would have found my way somehow, but I think you helped move it along more quickly, gave me the confidence, some of the access, the networks, and the support. But he said, but I still would have done something, obviously. And I think that's an important point we always think about in Europe. We don't save anyone. Our young adults are talented. We provide context and opportunity for them to realize that talent. So What I didn't know at that time, which we now know at Year Up, is David represents a much broader challenge in our country, which there are right now 6.7 million young adults who are what's called disconnected in this country. That means they're out of school, they're out of work, and they don't have more than a high school degree. So just think about that for a sec. So you're out of school, not going to school, you're not working, and you either have a high school degree or less, which means you either have a high school degree or you dropped out of college. What I just described to you is one out of five young adults in America today fit that description. Out of school, out of work, don't have more than a high school degree. And as you step back and think, how would we run a democracy? How would we run a civil society? How would we run a healthy economy in a skills-based economy if one out of five of our young people are effectively out of the game and not able to get into the economic mainstream of this country? And so when we pull back and said David is one, but there are 6.7 million, it really started getting me thinking about how do you create a program that could start to address that. And hence, in the year 2000, when I sold the business I had started back in 93, a software business, and I'd sold that business, I took every ounce of energy and what little brains I was given in life to try to figure out how do you now create a program that could scale nationally and start to close that opportunity divide for thousands of young people like David, and young men and women like David. So that was the genesis of Year Up. Year Up is simple. In 1 year, we help a low-income 18 to 24-year-old go from poverty to a professional career. That's what we do. We do it in 9 cities across the country with 1,500 young people. It's been evaluated through causal evaluation, which is important for anyone in nonprofit world or social science, which means we've proven what we do. We're not just claiming a result. It's been proven externally. People have looked at this model, studied it for several years, and said, you are causing the outcome of young people getting jobs and earning good wages in this country, which for me was heartening. Someone the other day said, why write a book? I said, well, I never, ever would have written a book had we not actually had proof that what we were doing was causal, that it actually was working for young people. And so that came to the starting to write a book and say, well, how do we shine a spotlight on this? Because the country now, we started keeping records in 1948 about unemployment for young people. And right here as we stand here today is the highest level those numbers have ever been since 1948. Imagine that. In this country, from World War II to today, the highest number of unemployed young people is right now. So it's we wanted to shine a spotlight on something that's working, to start to help people to see our young adults, the young people we serve, who happen to be low income, who happen to largely be of color. They happen to have several barriers when they get to us. So the young adults we serve may be coming out of foster care. They may be coming from a situation of homelessness in the past. They may have a difficult family situation. So they're coming with some barriers. But our fervent belief is that those barriers do not make someone damaged goods. They actually make you more resilient. If you can overcome those challenges, they actually make you stronger rather than weaker. And so when we look at young people and think of them from a strength-based perspective, not a deficit perspective, that they're actually assets, and it's up to our job to give them the context and the opportunity to realize their potential. What I'll do, I'm going to grab just one passage from a book, if you don't mind, Lisa. I may ask you to grab one book. I want to read one section to you. Thank you so much. Just to give you a sense of the young people we serve and where they came from, because it was difficult for me to write a book. That's so kind. Thanks so much. It was difficult to write a book because we followed 6 young people for a year in the program, and to really see up close what life was like for many of these young folks was painful for me to do, and I've been doing this for 12 years, to see some of the challenges that they faced. This was one young woman, Talisha. And the context for this is the first week of class, our students are invited to come up and over a timeline to write the significant milestones in their lives. So there's a timeline written up on big poster board, you have markers, and you can come up and write the significant events in your life. And if you'd like, you can come up and speak about those afterwards and really start to build a community and share with people what's happened, how your life's evolved. And they do this in several of the cities that we're in. This was about Talisha. Talisha, the 21-year-old single mother of a toddler son, pointed to her first entry, a 10-year separation from her two dearly loved younger brothers. She had never talked about it, not with the social workers who removed all three children from her mother's home when her brothers were just 2 and 4, not with her loving, tenacious foster mother, and certainly not with the succession of therapists assigned to her case. Talisha always stonewalled. They just stared at the clock and each other until the mandated appointments were up. Talisha didn't talk, period. She could not remember when she had had a friend and was only thankful that no one knew her business in her public housing complex in East Harlem. The first week she had brought her infant son, Jared, to live there, a 14-year-old boy shot directly at them with a handgun on their way in. Not aiming, just playing. He missed. And she had cupped the baby's downy head. "Welcome home, little man." Talk about it. It was all just so unspeakable. So what she was doing up in front of everyone? How did her legs even get her there? Tears rolled down her face. And Andres, who had been a caseworker at the social service agency that had shepherded Talisha's teen years, said quietly, "Take your time, and it's okay if you can't right now." Of the 6 young people we followed, each one of them had stories like this on that first week, and we chose students at random, literally random, to follow for a year. We just said, let's have 3 males and 3 females, and choose a class in New York, because that's where Europe conceptually started and in spirit. I'll read you one more quick one from Malik. Malik, an energetic, somewhat fidgety 18-year-old, loped up to the front and pointed out his own entry on the chart. They were easy to find. He had chosen a neon green marker. He pointed to his notation for 2006, "Brother killed." "I was at my 8th grade prom. That's when I got the news. I just got my dance on. The next day was graduation, and I was prom king. My brother Amadou came into the dance. He told me the news that our older brother Bakari was dead. At that time, my mind was almost blank. I went back to my home, and I could see everybody crying and everything, but I still couldn't believe it. I knew my brother was in the streets and all, but it didn't sink in. Then they were telling me how he died. They said that he got set up. He was strangled. They stuffed his body in a trunk, drove it to the dumpster, and wrapped him in a trash bag. They put him in the dumpster and set it on fire." That's when it clicked, those details. And I'm like, "Nah, you're not serious." Then they told me the people that did it were all in the same project. Now, I would love to tell you that those stories are rare amongst the 1,500 young people we serve. I would almost promise you 90%+ of the young people we serve could tell you a case of homicide of a family, friend, close relative, probably 90%+. I'd say in Baltimore, it's probably 100%. And yet at the very same time I say that, I can also promise you one other thing, that these young adults are some of the most resilient, hardworking, motivated, smart, capable young men and women I've ever met in my life. And if this country can't figure out how do we utilize that talent resident within those young individuals, we will not have a healthy democracy and a healthy economy. So the young adults who we followed for 6 years through this program, and this program year up, it's relatively simple. There's 6-month students come to us. They learn a set of skills that prepare them for a professional job. Those skills are one we call ABCs, attitudinal, behavioral, and communication skills. Things that you need to be a professional. Some people call them soft skills. And then we teach those young people something marketable, something like technology or finance, that we know there's a huge demand for and a growing demand for in our economy. They're in college credit, they're in a stipend, they're very well supported, mental health professionals, advisors, very caring adults in their lives. After that 6 months of an internship, those young people go, of training, those young people go into internships for 6 months, with one of about 250 companies across the country. from Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Salesforce, Big Fish here in Seattle, through to Citi, Goldman, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Coca-Cola, GE, NASA, the White House, all over this country. And the reason why it's grown, the reason why our program has grown is not that anything that we have done as staff, interestingly, it's because when those first 22 young people went to work, went to the internships, that they did well, and the companies that had them said, we want more. We actually want more young people. And because they said those three beautiful words, we want more, that the program's gone from 22 young people to 1,500 young people and is now the eighth fastest growing nonprofit in the country. That's a testament to the young people. It's a testament to who they are, what they can do, and the fact that we now have young people 35 years old who graduated from the program 11 years ago who own their own homes. One of my best days is when I get sent a picture of a home that our students now bought at the age of early 30s. And just what it means, one young man, Greg Walton, who is actually on our board now, is one of my bosses. And Greg sent me a series of photos. He said, Joe, when you grow up in a shelter, it's really hard to understand what it means when you open the front door, turn the key, and say to yourself, this is mine. And I'm never going to, I don't have to get kicked out of this. And then he sent me pictures of his man cave down in the basement. with a flat screen TV and the couch, invited me over. And he said, Joe, you just can't understand because I never knew my dad. And he has a beautiful son with his beautiful wife. He said, I will be the father my son never had. And my son will always have a home and always know he can get a good job because his dad has a good job. He's going to know he's going to go to college because his dad's in college. And if you think about breaking cycles of poverty, the research would say the single most important thing to help a child progress is correlated to whether mom and dad has a job. You see, what really matters is can a parent provide, as our young students are able to. So that is what we're trying to do with the book, is shed that spotlight. We have, when we started Year Up, we said we want to touch 10,000 people. That was the goal. And I remember the first business plan we wrote, 10,000 people. We said that. We had no one at the time, and people laughed at us. In fact, there was no one to laugh. It was just me. They laughed at me because there wasn't anyone else to laugh at. It was just me. And some of those people are actually family members, which actually hurts a little bit more. But I remember they laughed at us and said, you'll never do that. You're crazy. You're setting yourself up for failure. Well, in the next 3 years, we'll have touched cumulatively 10,000 individuals. And so when we look forward over the next 10 to 20 years, and we say, how do you take this model, which has gotten to 9 cities, soon to be 11 as we open up Silicon Valley and Miami, how do you get it to 100,000 people? And again, as I say that, people laugh again. And it's great. And it's just red rag to a bull. And say, how do you get it to 100,000? And you do it through your community college system. In working with and through community colleges, which have the infrastructure, which half of all Americans who go to college go to community college today, 13 million Americans, and the potential to help of what some of Year Up does around professional soft skills, as well as connecting very closely with labor markets and help work as closely as we can with community colleges. In some states, they're wonderful. Interestingly, Seattle, I think, is some of the best community colleges in our country. They're outstanding. Some states are not as fortunate. But we have that system in place, and so we really want to work through that system over time to help scale the program to many more individuals. So that's what we do. That's where the book was written. We're fortunate it's the number 8 bestseller on the New York Times list on Sunday. So we're pleased that that's got to a first hurdle of getting out there. And I fundamentally believe that if everyone out there saw our young people as assets and not liabilities, we would have a different United States today. Like, we'd have a different country. They would operate and act differently. And we wouldn't be in a country where we have poverty of opportunity and poverty of experience for many millions of young people. And I think if that's, we can live to see that day where poverty isn't defined as much by experience and opportunity, I think would be a better country for all. So that's our fervent hope, and we're lucky to work with such good staff, many of whom are here tonight, to to try to change that in our lifetimes, which we have our lifetimes and we have our watch, and each one of us says, what did we do on our watch? Right? What did we do on our watch? And so our hope is we can, in some small way, help to close that divide for those 6.7 million young people who need it. So let me stop there for a moment and see if folks have questions that I can answer, things they may want to discuss. I'd be happy to address them.
I have a question. I'd love to hear about this work between your program, Europe, and community colleges. How does that work?
So what we're doing, and the analog is you have ROTC in a four-year college. So go to Georgetown. I was at Georgetown recently. I was up at 5 a.m. to get a flight. Five young men were running by me in fatigues. They were students, right? They're college students, but they're actually going, they're in ROTC as well. If you can imagine that analog or the equivalent for that being called professional training corps and have that being a community college. So imagine swapping fatigues for business attire, swapping, learning about military moves, and let's focus on Microsoft mouse moves, and swap field training exercises for internships with companies linked to labor market demand and linked to skills that are in demand. So we really think that that could be a structure that could work in Europe would be within those community colleges, doing some of the things we do very well around support for young people, connections to labor markets, but also recognize that community colleges have vast resources themselves. So it's much more of a partnership model and an integration model that we're doing now in Baltimore and we'll soon do in Miami as of next month with Miami-Dade College. All right, so the internships in general, imagine companies are contributing to the to our organization to have a pipeline of talent that they, at the end of that program, can hire should they so desire. So they're really investing in this talent pipeline. That revenue stream is about 60% of our operating needs. So it's we're primarily funded by organizations that say we want to invest in a, want to invest in a pipeline of talent. That what we invest in our students, the students are in a stipend throughout the whole year, an educational stipend from training all the way through to their internship, which is about, depending on the city, about $8,000 per year. It can be a little bit higher, lower, between $7,000 and $9,000 per year. We will then invest about the same thing that my hometown, Cambridge, Mass., invests in 1 year of high school, which is about another $14,000 into that young person's education, their college credit. They're earning about up to 23 college credits when they're with us, which we pay for. So the net, the total cost is probably 23 if you look at a stipend plus all the other educational components going into that. And the interesting thing, Robinhood, one of the largest anti-poverty agencies in the world, and certainly in this country, has said that we're the highest return on investment that they've seen of this type of program. So a dollar invested into a young person, what's the incremental earnings they can get by having a better job? And so, yeah, we think a lot about outcomes, results, what someone receives as a result of going through the program, and then relentlessly try to get better at it. I mean, this is not simple, easy work, and we've chosen not to work with students one could say you'd make it anyways. We've chosen students we know have a lot of challenges. It would be very easy to go in the opposite direction, but we're trying to serve students well and still run a financially sound organization and put those two pieces together. So the coursework, if you imagine, you come at 8:30 in the morning. You have to be on time. We have clocks that are synchronized. If you're 1 second late, you're going to lose up to $25 of the $30 stipend you would have earned that day. So it's if you turn in assignments late, if you're not there present, if you use disrespectful language, you will lose part of that stipend. So there's very clear expectation and consequence, and we set very high expectations for our young folks and know they can hit those expectations. They're coming 8:30. They'll have four classes during the day of an hour and 20 minutes each. Two of those classes would probably be, one would be business communications. One would be around, say, either professionalism or customer service. And then two would probably be linked to the marketable skill you're studying. So it could be around computer applications and troubleshooting for help desk support, or for finance, it could be principles of personal finance, and then a course in how securities settle if you're going into, say, an investment operations arena for a bank. So imagine half of it is this ABC, attitude, behavior, communication. Half is marketable. But the environment is always professional. So we try to create a professional learning environment for young people so that the day you walk in, you dress properly. If you don't have clothes, we'll get you the clothes. But do you want to wear a suit and wear it with respect? That's what we're looking for a young person. You know, it's funny, when we go to the community college and do this, at first we said, what's going to happen? We're going to have a group of students dressed like I am right now in a community college. Are they going to be ridiculed? Is it going to cause a problem? So here's what's happening. They're considered cool. Other students are saying, well, what are you guys getting? This looks pretty good. Other teachers in the community college are saying, wow, those students are behaving incredibly well in class. So we're shifting the expectations for behavior in the community college setting in both Baltimore, where we've currently been doing this for a few years, of this integrated model. Has it been powerful? You asked a question about for the student what's most powerful. I almost guarantee it's belief in oneself. If I were to say what is the key thing, it's walking by one of those glass and steel buildings and saying, I belong there. I deserve to work there. I have a right to work there. And I'm worthy intellectually of working there. It's a huge light. I've heard so many students describe cathartically what it's felt like to be in Salesforce.com or a JP Morgan and to look around and say, I'm here with all these professionals and I'm doing okay. And it literally was a light bulb of belief in oneself. You know, I think we do huge damage to young people by not expecting enough from them. And I always say to our students, the most respect we can pay to you is to expect a lot from you. And we will never lower standards. We don't want to dumb down a program. We want to keep standards high because we think that's respectful to the young people we serve. And so many of them come up. I always ask students at the end of the program, if we did away with that contract, would you be happy? It's pretty onerous. You got to be here at 8:30. If you miss, you lose your stay. They'll say, thank you for giving me structure. Thank you for telling me honestly what does the corporate world expect from me. And thanks for not lowering your standards, because for much of my life, people just let me get by. So it renews my faith in young people if we hold them accountable. So when we first go into a new city, we'll typically go to high schools, guidance counselors who may know students who are going to graduate but have no next step, go to a community-based organization, potentially a foster care agency. It would be kind of the normal routes when we went into a first organization. It could be a church setting. After about 2-3 years, it starts to switch to be word of mouth. Whereas now in a more mature city like Boston, it's probably 80% of our students come through word of mouth. It's siblings, brothers, cousins, and it really shifts pretty radically. And we measure that every semester to see if word of mouth is increasing, believing that that means our students are telling other students about it. They go through an admissions process, which is an application. In Chicago, 1,200 students put their name down on a piece of paper, said, I'm interested in the program, but only 225 turned in an application. So there's a real gap between saying you're interested and actually demonstrating that you're now ready to take this next step. And we consciously do that to see who's ready to take that next step. And then typically our students will come in for probably one individual interview with a social worker to understand where this young person coming from, and then often come in for a group interview as well. We do what's called a learning assessment. It's really not to say who's smart or not smart, and I don't believe that's fundamentally a good way to think about young people. But we do try to screen out if someone had a significant learning disability that we couldn't teach to. That would be unfair to that student to take them in. Our average student probably is around a 9th grade ability with a normal distribution between 7th and 12th. It's probably 7, 8, peak around 9, 10, and 11 to 12. These are all high school grads, but that's, you know, from the assessments we've done, that's probably 9th, 10th grade on average that they would test at. If one, you know, test can be very challenging for some of the populations we serve for a lot of different reasons, cultural and could be English as a second language. The dropout rate, 4 out of 5 students, typically, if you look across the country, can be higher and lower in cities over time as we calibrate and get this right. But 4 out of 5 students will get through the first 6 months of training, that training phase. And then if they get into the internship after that, probably 9 out of 10 will make it through the internship and either meet or exceed expectations of their corporate partners over the whole program, then if you did that math, it's about 70% graduation rate from 100 students starting to 70 graduating at the end of 1 year. Of the 225 that apply, 80 will be accepted in Chicago. Yeah, yep, that's correct. And for some, there's two reasons. Either if we don't have enough spots, we'll just admit you for the next class. For some folks, they need something different than what we're providing. So someone may need substance abuse counseling. That's not what we do as our mainstay. Or they may need English as a second language. I'll tell you one story. The young man's son, he came to the first class, lovely young man from China. He was probably only in this country about 2 weeks, and he wanted to apply, and he really didn't speak English at all. I mean, if you said, could you fill out this form? He just had motivation, but he didn't yet have the English language under his belt. We found him some money to go to Harvard Extension School to take a course in English. And we're all excited. When son came back, second class, ready to admit son, he still had a big gap in his English. There was no way he could have understood our classes. So we gave him another course in English. And we didn't hear from him for a little while. And I was near Fenway Park one day, and I was getting a Coca-Cola at a McDonald's, and I saw out of the corner of my eye someone running from behind the counter, waving a spatula. And it was Sun saying, I'm ready, Gerald, I'm ready. And next thing you know, Sun came into the program, did well for 9 years. He's been the web and IT manager for one of the major law firms in Boston. Burns and Levinson is a very well-known firm in our neck of the woods. Every year he sends me a card for Chinese New Year. And on my birthday, he sends me 2 digital cards on the internet. And he gave me a whole book in Chinese culture. I mean, just this fascinating young man. And I wondered, would our country ever take advantage of what he has to offer? You know, he's an asset to this country and a taxpayer to this country. For 9 years, he's been paying taxes. So it's one of the things we do is important is, if a student applies to us, we really don't leave them hanging. If they need other support, we're going to try to refer them to another agency. If they need something other than what we provide, we want to be thoughtful in how we do that. It's just kind of our DNA is, when someone has gone to the trouble of applying to us, they're in our program, and we want to try our best to, if we can't serve them, who else in the city can serve them, and you know, what other agencies might be appropriate? It's a great question. Great question. I think the answer is, once work starts to fragment, because technology allows it to go pretty fluidly, I think that may allow us to think about that problem. So, I know the JetBlue reservations people can now log in anywhere and fill in their reservations. So I think there's a potential to, as work goes out through technology to very fragmented areas, that's the only way I can see we could do it, because we have to have some way to aggregate either people or jobs, you know, because we still use a lot of personal interaction. We'll use technology more over the years. But until technology evolves, both in the educational and the work front, I think we're going to be in urban areas, but I wouldn't say that's forevermore. I mean, technology is changing pretty quickly, and that's one of my mentors, advisors, is always talking about, think about rural poverty. In fact, it's a huge issue in this country and how we might be able to help that as well. So there are communities that I think, so we've wanted to go to Dallas or Houston, but if you don't have a transportation system, a public transportation system, people who live in poverty or poor areas can't get to white-collar jobs. And so what an appreciation I now have for urban planning is when you create a city and how do you think about public transportation. So there are some cities we'd love to go to, but you literally, if you don't have a car, you are locked out. And even in my own hometown of Boston, when white-collar work gets suburbanized out to the what we call the 495 ring, what that does to inner cities if you don't have transportation to get in and out. So there are a lot of cities that don't have the public transportation that could cause a problem. With the new model we're developing, which is going to take time to test and develop, I think we could go to many more places, but it's going to take several years to get that model right and prove that it works properly. Yeah, I think Europe hopefully will always be humble enough to never think that we have to solve a problem or we have the ability to solve a problem. If we can be a catalyst for a problem being solved, that's just as good. So I was on the phone this morning with the president of Northern Virginia Community College, the third largest community college in the country, 78,000 students. And the, Dr. Templin, their president, he said, you know, there's probably a state strategy here. He said, we're one community college, but when you think about it, there's a state system that he's very plugged into. He's a very, very strong champion of ours, and he understands what we do. So if you have really strong leadership in the system, combined with what some of the things we can do, I think you could look at a state much more broadly than just one college. I think we have to be realistic ourselves, though, that these aren't 1 or 2 year journeys. We've been doing this for 12 years, and we're now able to take that next big step. It took 12 years to get in that position. And it's, you know, it's challenging work. I mean, it is challenging work. We buried two young people in May. You know, this is not work for the faint of heart. And I know there's some folks here who work with populations that can be challenging. You know, our staff are some of the most resilient folks I know, but they're put under pressure every day. So I also think, you know, many of our community colleges, it's not because they don't want to serve hard-to-serve populations. It takes incredible amounts of adult time and support to help young people, and community colleges aren't funded to do that. I mean, they weren't fundamentally designed and funded to do it. So I think we have to recognize that support's critical and it costs money and it takes adults. That's one of the things we can probably do. And also, I think the role of soft skills in career readiness is a probably more important concept in a knowledge-based economy where skills become the premium. And so how that more broadly infuses into our community college system, I think, would be helpful as well. So our courses are all validated. So student comes to Year Up, they're dual enrolled in, say, City College of San Francisco, or here, obviously, Bellevue, our partner here in Seattle, who's wonderful, and or Metropolitan College of Atlanta, Northern Virginia Community College. Those faculty chairs have to come to our site, approve our faculty as being adjuncts, which means they have to have the requisite education. They'll then approve our courses to map that course to their course. So if it's business communications, it has to map to their equivalent course. We have to follow a grading system that would be equivalent to their grading system. Student reviews have to be done. So students review the teacher. That goes back to the community college as well. So I would say it's pretty equivalent to the course in a community college, with the difference being we can provide a lot of support. We do developmental education during a credit-bearing course, which is different in some cases than other schools. So if we know a student has trouble, we will put more support on that student. And we only work in about a 1-to-20 ratio of faculty to students. So we're able to put a little bit more time into each student. And that's certainly different. Developmental education is a huge challenge for many community colleges, a real big challenge. What we found, we had 35% of our students test into developmental English in Baltimore, and teachers like, this is going to be a problem. We said, let us try to work with those young people. The teacher wasn't cutting them any slack. 100% passed the English course, much higher percentage than the other population that they were sitting alongside. So we're starting to learn, can you combine developmental education concomitantly with credit-bearing courses and still get the passing of a grade? I do. I serve on the Board of Education for Massachusetts, the K-12 system in Mass, which is about 1 million children. And the last big effort I was involved in, we led a task force on career readiness for middle and high school students, and trying to help our school system see that young people need to understand the world of work. They need experiences during high school to see, well, what does an engineer do, or what does an artist do, or what does a doctor do? Just experiences. They need internships. Teachers can benefit from externships during the summer to see what this world of work looks like. And then to have some expectation that students can pull knowledge down about what would I need to do to get that job? How would I prepare for that? How does counseling not just be college counseling, but kind of success counseling, to look more broadly at not just college, but a career in college and how young people transition? So I think there's a counseling component that could be a lot richer in high schools. I think we could infuse a lot more career readiness into high schools and to recognize that every single person, it's not voc tech students and not students going into trades, it's all students need to have some form of career readiness. And you say, why? Well, I'll tell you why. And let's do we'll do this test I do with many audiences. Humor me for a sec. Raise your hand if you have a college degree. Keep your hand up for a sec. Keep it up if you got the degree between the ages of 18 and 22. Just have a quick look around. It's about 50%, maybe. Yeah, about 50, 60% of this audience. If you ask those same two questions of any 100 adults in America today, only 8 hands would be up. So only 8 out of 100 adults across all of America have a college, a 4-year college degree that they got between the ages of 18 and 22. And the average age of a Bachelor of Arts is 28 in America today. And the average student, at least in UMass Boston, works 30 hours a week. So when you add all those together, you realize that we think of education and work as linear systems. You go to school, you go to work. That is not the way Americans do it today. They work while they go to school. They feed their bellies and they feed their brains at the same time. So if young people aren't coming out of high school with some sense of how would I make money, how would I do pay-worthy things as well as credit-worthy things, I think we really hamstring young people coming in. And it's everyone needs post-secondary education in this country, everyone. Question is, there's not just one path and it's not just a 4-year fixed-term residential degree. It's multiple pathways into the mainstream. And promoting that more broadly, I think, would be in our economy's interest and our country's interest. Any final questions? Yes. Maybe 2 more and we'll finish up. Maybe here and then we'll go back. Yes, ma'am. So the near future will grow from about 1,500 young people to 2,500 young people. Open up just a few more cities. We'd much rather grow in Seattle and grow in Atlanta. The cities we're already in would much rather grow more deeply and get the model right. I mean, it takes time to get this right. It's not just cookie cutter, you just grow it. It takes time. So we'd want to grow in those cities to about 2,500 and at the same time start to launch these models in community colleges that we think could get to a much higher number of young people in years to come. And so that's the kind of next 5-year plan. We do a lot of work in Washington. We do a lot of work at a state level. We're heavily involved now in a pay-per-performance initiative so that government only funds results rather than efforts. So we'd say only give money to people like Europe if you can show results. And then helpfully Darwin takes over and more nonprofits are rewarded for results rather than efforts. So it's a big initiative now. Obama put money in the budget for it. Governor Patrick put money in the budget for it in Massachusetts. That's starting to happen in this country. So we do a lot of work around advocacy for things we think would be in the best interest of the system getting better over time. Just last question here. Yeah, we backed it into a high school for a while. The challenge was the maturity, sometimes the students going into work at a company at the age of 17 versus 19 or 20 was really significantly different. The point you make, your biggest return on investment is probably everything from neonatal through to early elementary to early literacy. And we could put all of our resources there, but the fact is we'd have to mortgage 20 years of a generation. So I think about a barbell strategy is help youth make sure they connect to work, because we know work is critical. And at the same time, you probably want to front load a lot of resources on the youngest children out there and help them not need a year up. I mean, if I could be a little bit crass, Europe is a little bit like an emergency room, right? We need emergency rooms. People have crises. You're going to need a year up. But if your strategy is to grow emergency rooms, it's probably not a good strategy. Because as one would say, emergency room is a relatively intensive intervention and effort. It's not to do away with them. It's just not strategically to say we're just going to grow them forever. It would be much better if over time we could work on prevention and health to prevent as many folks from needing that intensive level of medical care. And yeah, we absolutely buy that. It's one of the reasons why I joined the Board of Education is to look at kindergarten and see what can happen there and reduce the need for what we do. Yeah, it's a great question. I'm going to finish there. I know I'll happily sign a few books if anyone should so desire. I want to say a real thanks to the folks in Seattle, the staff that are here. You had graduation today, which I know is beautiful. Beautiful day in our year. And also thank you to the library, Chris, for your support and making this possible. So thank you so much. I wish you well and hope you have a good evening. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for coming. Gerald will be at the front table to sign books. Thanks again, Elliott Bay.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.